I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. Welcome.
Thank you.
Could you describe what your home looks like in New York City, in the West Village?
Did you ever read... which is the book? Is it Our Mutual Friend? It's the one with Jarndyce and Jarndyce, and there's the Rag and Bone Man shop with all this... just everything is stacked to the ceilings, books piled up 4 feet high. It's a mess. It's a complete mess. And I work in there and live in there and entertain in there. It's a wonderful 1950s. I think they were built as kind of bachelor pads in the 50s. Very, very streamlined. It's a staircase that comes down on the wraparound balustrade. But it's all buried now. It's very clean lines, but it's all completely buried. I don't know what this is. It's like living in a boat in New York. I have to have paper and paints and a lot of materials and a lot of reference books. And I have tons of music and tons of CDs, DVDs.
When you say that you also entertain in there, do you feel the inclination to clean up before your guests come? What kind of entertaining do you do in there?
Not much anymore. But I used to actually have a grand piano in the living room, and I used to have concerts. Friends would come over and perform, and we'd invite maybe 30, 40, 50 people. There's actually no room to do that anymore. The neighbors complain, too.
You worked on Olivia in your bedroom on an easel, and there's a quote you once said.
Yes, I had a one-room studio apartment at that point, so there was nothing but the bed.
Yeah, and you said at one point, I nearly had a nervous breakdown. I'd go to bed staring at the work, then wake up with it.
Yes. You need a lot of floor space. People are always saying, why don't you get a dog? Paper, floor, dog, no.
What is your ideal workspace?
Ideally, I would like to have a whole townhouse where I could have office space in the basement and then two floors to live on and two floors to work on.
Mm.
And separate space for doing sculpture and stuff like that.
Mm.
And theater design, which is really messy, and other space for painting and drawing. So
somehow I think you might fill that space with
I would. I think, yeah.
What is your work habit? Are you working during the day?
Yeah, I tend to work a lot at night. Start about 5 in the evening and then work till 4 in the morning or something. It's the only time the phone doesn't ring. It's quiet.
What time did you wake up this morning?
9:30. Well, I didn't get to sleep until 7, so.
Until 7 a.m.
So you. I have a trouble getting to sleep when I know I have to do something the next day.
Yes.
Like get on a plane or go to the dentist or be interviewed on... At least it's not live.
And do you find that the public part of your work like a distraction?
Oh, absolutely. I find it an absolute pain in the neck. Very distracting. Yeah, I can't do anything else. Well, they were really smart. Nobody told me about it. Nobody reminded me about this until last night. So I didn't have 3 days to go sweat.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. You are an artist in various mediums. You do costume and set design. You've illustrated, been the author and illustrator for Olivia. You create New Yorker magazine covers. When you were younger and you had aspirations to be an artist, did you have a vision of, you know, one of those vehicles for expressing your art?
I always liked doing lots of different things. My father was a wonderful amateur carpenter. He could build anything, shelves, cabinets, cabinetry. He was an architect. And he had a great shop, which he let me play in all the time. So I learned very early how to make things. And I don't know what my mother must have thought. Me, as a 6-year-old kid using a radial arm saw, is a little terrifying. Drill presses and a lathe. We had a lathe. It could turn candlesticks and things. Really dangerous. Essentially, you know, we say, oh, he does theater and draws and paints. But essentially, that's much the same thing. It all involves drawing.
You grew up in Ridgefield, Connecticut, right? Ridgewood?
No, I was born in Ridgefield, but I was actually moved from there when I was about 4. We moved to an island off the coast of Connecticut in Long Island Sound, just half a mile offshore. It was absolutely idyllic, very beautiful. It's called Tavern Island. It's just our house, one house.
And how did your family come to live on an island, and how did you end up being the only family on that island, or the only house on that island?
It was an old house. It's a turn of the century house, and we'd always sailed around it. And my parents saw it came up. It came up for sale. It used to be owned by Billy Rose, the great Broadway impresario, and it was very silly. It had Italian sculptures of muses and putti, little babies and things all over it, and peacocks and huge amount of animals. We had a huge amount of animals, which may be why I'm so good at anthropomorphizing my pig. We had at one point 18 peacocks, 4 guinea fowl, ringneck pheasants, golden pheasants, birds, and because we'd feed them, we also got all the neighborhood ducks and geese that would come and just plop themselves on the lawn. And then there were all the abandoned ducklings that we got re-raised. And there was, at one point, my sister had found 5 ducklings that were with no mother, and they printed on her and would follow her around in a little train like ducklings do, and it was so adorable. We had this circle of chicken wire that we put on the beach in the water so they could swim without escaping and be protected from other creatures, and one of them got caught, its head got caught, and the tide was coming in, and it was not breathing, and I held its bill closed and I gave it mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and it lived. And my sister thought I was a hero from then on.
It sounds idyllic and great material for your work. Did your parents make a conscious decision to give you, this eclectic way of life? Or was it just, of course, this is what we're going to do, is have 18 peacocks?
Well, they were there on the island when we got it.
You grew up there with your 2 sisters, Tonya and Victoria, as well as your parents. Your father was a carpenter and architect. And what did your mother do?
She actually taught art sometimes, and she ran a sailing school, and we're always involved with boats, so that's, I suppose, why we ended up on an island.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. In addition to creating the book series, he's designed sets and costumes for the New York City Ballet, the San Francisco Opera, the Royal Opera House in London, and the Théâtre du Châtelet in Paris. Ian also creates covers for the New Yorker magazine. So fast forward, was there any question that you would do anything else with your life other than make art?
Well, my parents didn't like the idea that much because it's hard to make a living as an artist. So I was sent to NYU and I did art history and then flunked out after 2 years because I really didn't want to be an art historian at all. Then I went to Parsons.
In New York City?
Yeah.
Can you talk to me some more about the early period when you were at NYU having a difficult moment in your life when you were studying art history and all you wanted to do was make art? Like, what was the what was the 18-year-old Ian Falconer like?
Well, I would still make things, even though I wasn't in an art school. But as my father said, well, he's majoring in Studio 45. Intentionally getting it wrong. I was a wild 18-year-old, yeah. I got to New York from a boarding school in Massachusetts, believe me.
All right, so you were majoring in Studio 54.
It was really, really fun. It was a time in New York when the uptown people and the downtown people all mixed together in a different way. And now the downtown people all live in Brooklyn separate. And it was a much more vibrant, wild city than it is now. And it was amazing looking around a room and seeing, well, there's Frank Perdue, and there's Martha Graham, and there's Barbara Streisand, and there's Liza Minnelli, and there's everybody was there. Everybody was doing cocaine at that time, from museum directors, socialites, not just kids. It was everybody passing around little vials at dinner parties and things. No food got eaten.
Did drugs fuel your creativity even at that time?
No. It's a waste of time.
Okay, so during this time, after leaving NYU, you went to Parsons Art School in New York City.
Yeah, and I met a lot of people in the art world, and through one of them, Henry Geldzahler, who used to be the Commissioner of Cultural Affairs, I met David Hockney. He said he offered me work out in Los Angeles, and they have a sister school, Parsons Otis Art Institute, in Los Angeles. So I transferred out there and worked for him for about 13 years.
Now, David Hockney, the artist.
The artist, yes.
Was also, he was creating sets.
He was doing, yeah.
For theater and opera in Los Angeles.
Yes, that's what I was working with him on. So I got really good training through that.
Berated.
In the studio and in the theater.
And you collaborated with David professionally, and you also were his boyfriend for a few years. Is that is that right?
At the beginning, yeah.
How long were you partners as well?
Oh, I don't know. Does it ever really end? I'm still in touch with him all the time, and I love him dearly.
Describe that experience for me of creating and set designing.
Well, music has always been very important to me. So working on the operas and the ballet was... Ballet, not so much, but the opera is thrilling. Learning from David, he would always say, if you're stuck for an idea, listen to the music, love, listen to the music. And he always take it back to the music, which a lot of designers don't.
Would you listen to the music as you were designing to give you inspiration?
Can you? Over and over again. Every available recording we could find of the thing we would play.
What's an example of one of the projects you worked on with him?
Tristan and Isolde, Turandot, which is still in circulation, plays a lot. Die Frau in Schatten, which is a Strauss opera.
So David was a real mentor. What are some things that he taught you, whether it's about the world of art or...
Well, he's very
work.
Passionate about art, so yes, I learned a lot about painting. But technically, he says, it's that an art school can't teach you art. It can only teach you how to use a pencil and a brush and oil paints. And it can only teach you techniques, really. It's up to you to make the art. He draws constantly, all the time. They're always interesting, and he's tireless.
In a way, creating sets for opera or ballet is very three-dimensional, and a lot of your work, though, has also been, on the page. Mm-hmm. How do you think about that?
I tend to do painted drop sets, so they're layers of illusionistic painting and not built sets. One reason is because when you build a set, you tend to be stuck with that set, whereas when you have drop sets, you can change it instantly, and you can have many, many, many different scene changes, which people love.
And in a way, it's more of connective tissue to the books and the magazines, because it's a little more two-dimensional, in a way.
But you can get some great three-dimensional illusions that way, forcing perspective and all that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. We'll hear more from Ian coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the artist Ian Falconer. He's the author and illustrator of the Olivia children's book series about a pig inspired by his niece, also named Olivia. The first Olivia, published in 2000, won the Caldecott Award, among other accolades. Ian is a set and costume designer for opera and dance, and he's created numerous covers for the New Yorker magazine since 1996. So moving forward from your life in Los Angeles, designing sets with David Hockney, to New York, where you created Olivia in your Greenwich Village apartment, what was the impetus for moving back to New York City?
My lease was up in Los Angeles, and I thought, do I want to move to another house here, or do I? I was actually only going to spend maybe 6 months back in New York. My family's all here, so I thought it'd be nice, and I ended up staying.
Were you feeling like satisfied professionally, or were you feeling like, I have a book in me, or what was your?
I was actually a bit at a loss because I had a gallery in Los Angeles, but I didn't have a gallery in New York, and my paintings were not fashionable at that time.
What did they look like?
I do portraits and landscapes and interiors and still lifes. Having worked with David Hockney all those years, I'd known art dealers for a long time, and they're a funny breed. I remember going to Robert Miller Gallery, I think, and it was his assistant at that point who saw me, and he didn't like my stuff, and so he suggested that I go to another gallery that handled Peter Schlesinger, one of David Hockney's old boyfriends. Mm. And I thought that was the worst put down. Go to David's ex-boyfriend gallery. I wasn't quite sure what to do, and I thought, well, I've got to make some money. So I'll send in some things to the New Yorker magazine, and amazingly, they liked my work, which is a dream for an illustrator. Any illustrator would like like that job.
Did you have any connections at the New Yorker, or you just pretty much put your material in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and sent it in?
I had a friend who knew somebody who knew a guy named David Kuhn who worked with Tina Brown.
Who was the former editor.
And I came and gave them to him. He didn't look seem very impressed with them, and I think he didn't want to get me to get my hopes up or anything. But so all I can do is show them to the editor, and my editor, Françoise Mouly, who's wonderful. I didn't hear anything from them, and I finally thought, well, I'll write a note and just say I haven't gotten my drawings back. If you have any suggestions, I'd love to hear them. Mm-hmm. And this is my phone number. And the next day, she called me up and said, "Oh, darling, hello. I do want you to come up and see my office, see what's on the wall." They didn't use any of the drawings I sent them, but it took me almost a year to get my first cover. But I. It did support me. They were very generous at that time. They used to buy in things even if they didn't use them. And it was while I was doing that, Olivia was born. And she was the first kid in the family.
Now, this was in 1996, and you were in your mid to late 30s when the New Yorker picked you up. What was the first cover that you did for the New Yorker?
It was 4th of July, and it was an image of the arm of the Statue of Liberty, and she's holding a sparkler instead of a torch. Not the best joke in the world, but it was a nice visual.
The New Yorker paid you up front each year so that it mm-hmm. freed you up to not only create for the New Yorker, but to work on various other projects, including Olivia.
And theater, yeah. And I started doing Olivia so I would have more time to paint. But as I've lived in New York, every year it's gotten so much more expensive over the last 15 years. That I kept having to do more books.
Right.
I was trying to buy a studio at one point, and then the housing market all fell apart. So eventually, I think the next book might be called Olivia Pays the Rent.
The inspiration for Olivia, the book series, is your niece, Olivia Crane, mm-hmm. who lives in Connecticut. When did you first think to create a gift for your niece? Because it was a gift initially, right?
Yes. I started drawing this little character and putting it together, and I realized that it was actually pretty good, really kind of funny. The character was very funny, and I took it into William Morris Agency. They had a children's book department. The woman there said, "I like it. I like the drawings, but it's not an Eloise yet. It's not an Eloise." And okay, she said, "Well, we'll hook you up with another. It's your first time author. You'll never get published without. I'll put you together with an established author." And no, I don't want it to be illustrated by Ian Falcon. I've created this character, so I took it home and put it away. And then I got a call from somebody at Simon & Schuster, from Ann Schwartz, who'd seen my New Yorker stuff, and said, "Would you like to illustrate a children's book?" And I said, "Here you go." I brought her the illustration. She loved it, absolutely loved it. That was it.
Describe to me how you felt when you got that call. These are momentous pivot points in your life, whether it was the New Yorker saying, "Yeah, come on in," or Anne saying, "I love the work." Like,
well, I get very, very, very shy about showing my work. So I remember going up there absolutely terrified. Not terrified, but shaky and nervous. And Anne said, "We were actually really worried about you when we first we thought, who is this creature that we're getting involved with here?"
You mean when they saw you for the first time?
Yeah.
In person. Why? How would you describe what you're like in person?
I tend to get sort of shaky and jittery, nervous, very nervous. You're making me nervous right now. Just talking about it is making me nervous. It was great. But I didn't have that high hopes for it, even when they said yes, because thousands of children's books come out every year, and many of them just go under the radar. They don't get noticed. They were terrific, Simon & Schuster. They put a lot of advertising behind it, and it became very popular. And the Caldecott, of course. That was very funny because they called me at, I think, about 8 o'clock in the morning. I was in a deep slumber, and they said, "Guess what? You've won the Caldecott medal." And I was like, "Oh, great. Thank you. Thank you." I don't think it even really occurred to me what the Caldecott was and how important it was. I soon found out when some of my children's book writing friends started steaming about it.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, about a precocious pig. How would you describe who Olivia is? What's her personality?
She's confident, very confident. Seems to know what she wants. She's contrarian, so just when you think you know what she's going to do next, she'll surprise you by doing the opposite. She wants to do everything herself. She wants to make everything herself. She has a strong imagination.
You mentioned that you had a lot of animals around the house, which is why you might be good at anthropomorphizing in your work. Did you ever think Olivia, the pig, might be a different animal? How did pig come to mind?
Olivia has this very turned-up little nose. And when she was a little kid, you know, little kids, their heads are always a little bit too big for their bodies, and she just looked like a little piglet. Pigs are also very intelligent. Considering they only have trotters, apparently they can get into any cabinet or anything. They're very clever.
The palette for Olivia is spare. There's sort of an economy in the colors that you use.
I think too much color, too much detail, too much stuff distracts from the story. I think that the simplicity of the way Olivia is drawn allows you to see, really concentrate on her facial expressions, which I work very hard on her facial expressions to get it. It's just a tiny little dot for the eye, but you have to get it right, and you end up erasing it over and over and over again, and just to get the right surprise or whatever the look is on her face. I have a sort of technique that I developed for these books. People always think that they're airbrushed, but they're not. I get those women's makeup tools, you know, those cotton balls and cotton swabs and things to do the shadowing, to give this delicate, soft shadowing, and then outline it with charcoal. Then you paint on the gouache, and then you can shade the gouache with the charcoal as well to get that three-dimensional quality. And then the shadow underneath her feet so that she seems to stand on a plane on the floor.
You use the same economy, not just in the palette, but in the language. The words are so simpatico with the art.
I found when I'm working on other illustrating things for other people that I don't have that same feeling of the organic whole of doing the books myself and writing them. And when you're working on the books with the editor at the stage where you've got all the drawings and you're working with the text, you'll keep changing the text and altering things, which if you're with an author, sometimes they never even meet these authors and illustrators, and you wonder, what the hell? Collaborate. Yeah. A lot of people have trouble collaborating. That's the great thing about theater, is you learn how to collaborate with other people. You have to work with them, or or else.
Who are some children's authors or illustrators whom you're particularly fond of, or whom you think about as reference points for you?
I love Maurice Sendak, of course. He's truly a giant. His book, and oddly enough, a lot of people don't like it as much as his other books, but is Higgledy Piggledy Pop, if you've ever read it. First of all, it's all in black and white. It's all, I think, pencil or charcoal, graphite or charcoal, I'm not sure. And it's a wonderfully dark tale for children, surreal dark tale for children. Mm-hmm. Dr. Seuss, absolutely. And again, those old two-color printing processes that they used to use, a lot of the early Dr. Seuss books, it's only one color and black and white because it was cheaper. That was it was very expensive to do a four-color lithograph at that time. Mm-hmm. It's not now. In fact, Olivia's black and white drawings are all done in four-color, five-color, I think it is, so that to get the richness in the charcoal, because charcoal has a lovely warmth to it.
Does the stripe of her sweater at all reference the stripe of the cat in the hat, the cat's hat?
No. No, first of all, stripes delineate the shape of the body wonderfully. They show bulges and all the curves and shapes in the body. But I always liked stripes, whether they're fisherman's stripes, fisherman shirts, and things like that.
We talk about David Hockney as being an important figure in your life. What other artists have had an impact on you?
Not many living artists that I can think of right now. Certainly, I've been influenced by the large figures of the 20th century, Picasso and Matisse. And, well, I don't know how you could not be influenced by Picasso. And he had this extraordinary facility from a very early age, which allowed him to do anything, pretty much anything he wanted. He could paint like a 50-year-old man when he was 10. His father was a painter and painted little pictures for tourists of pigeons, doves. And Picasso, I don't know, 3 years old or something, copied one of his father's paintings and did it so well that his father just put down his brushes and said, "You do it now."
You mentioned Picasso and Matisse, I think of as an explosion of color.
No, very controlled, though. It's very hard to use color, and he does it beautifully. So does Hockney.
Even though Olivia is not soaked in color.
It reads as color, though. It doesn't read as, to me, it doesn't read as a black and white book. The first book does have just one color. The second book has a cup, like red and pink. And the third book has green and red, but it's tightly controlled.
There's also an appeal for adults in Olivia. And some say that it was an instant success because parents liked Olivia. For instance, there's references to Maria Callas and, of course, Degas and Jackson Pollock in the first Olivia, and later Eleanor Roosevelt. And to what extent are you kind of winking at parents concurrently while you're also trying to appeal to the little people?
There are a couple things. One is the parents frequently have to read these books over and over and over again because kids love repetition. They love being able to anticipate. They know what's coming next. The other thing is, I think when the child and the parent are bonding together reading, it really helps if the parent laughs, because children will laugh at what their parents will. And they'll also try and figure out what their parents are laughing at. I think it helps.
You created this initially as a gift for your niece, Olivia, and obviously it's become much larger than that. To what extent has your family gotten involved in this?
My niece, it's very funny. Olivia never, she just took it all, I guess as children do, she just took it all in stride. Of course, there's a book about me. she used to autograph them for kids at school. In fact, I was doing a book signing once when she was the first book, and she was very little. And she came up and just without being asked, sat down next to me and started just signing in a big, slow, O-L-I. And there are people lined up for, 300 people deep back there waiting. And Olivia signs it. It's very cute.
I could see for other families who may not want to have a public presence, you have made them public in a way that maybe they might not have expected.
But I don't think many people outside of her school or her friend circle know that she's that Olivia. Town library, maybe.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Ian Falconer, the creator of the children's book series Olivia, About a Pig. The series exists in almost 30 languages, and Olivia debuted in 2009 on Nickelodeon as a TV series. Ian has also designed sets and costumes for various opera and ballet companies, and he's worked in collaboration with the essayist David Sedaris on a stage version of Santaland Diaries, among other projects. I want to talk about Tom Ford for a minute. He's a fashion designer, and he's also the director of the movie A Single Man by Isherwood. You were partners with Tom Ford.
Yeah, we met at NYU. We were in the same class at NYU.
One of the reasons I bring him up is in his movie, the lead character is a gentleman, George, and George's last name in the movie is Falconer. You being somebody kind of private, have been the object. You've been on the other side, in a way, by being George Falconer. You are Falconer.
Yes, there's no last name in the book, so he needed to invent one for the screen, and that was very sweet of him. Very, very sweet of him.
What role did he play in your life? I assume, are you still friends? And
yes.
You both obviously met each other at a very formative stage, both very young at NYU. How do you think you have influenced each other's lives or careers, if at all?
I don't know. I'm not sure we have that much. He's been a wonderful friend, but we're very different people.
You're both in the milieu of meeting other artists and...
But he's always immaculate and put together, and his house is absolutely pristine, clean, crisp. And I'm a slob and messy. He's very social. I'm not. Cares what he looks like. I don't. I have 6 white Brooks Brothers shirts and 6 pairs of blue jeans, and that's makes it so much easier.
Incidentally, there are a number of children's books created by single men who don't have children. Maurice Sendak comes to mind.
Yes.
Where the Wild Things Are. Do you think it's just coincidence, or you know, talk to me about that. You don't have children.
No. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That is an odd thing. I hadn't thought of that. I think possibly that single middle-aged men have never grown up themselves and maintain a kind of attachment to childhood that other people may not have when they've married and are saddled with children, and they also may not have time to the luxury of time to sit and think and draw and diddle and doodle. I used to have a macrobiotic teacher in California during one of my California health things, and she always said that gay men have made some subconscious decision not to take responsibility. And I bristle at that, but more and more I think maybe she's a little bit right there. They tend to postpone adolescence into their 50s.
You mentioned macrobiotics. Are you focused on eating well? And
I try, but it's not that easy in New York City. Maybe it's my neighborhood.
The West Village.
The West Village. Tends to be either high-end or pizza.
Ernest Hemingway says he talks about doing the best work on an empty stomach.
Yeah, I often don't eat until dinner. It keeps you sharper. Yeah, it does.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been the artist Ian Falconer. Coming up, we'll meet Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a company that offers indoor cycling classes through the New York metro region, Long Island, and Los Angeles. Elizabeth and Julie opened their first studio in 2006 on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and the company has grown rapidly in popularity, attracting clients like Chelsea Clinton, Conan O'Brien, Katie Couric, and Kelly Ripa. SoulCycle classes are 45 minutes long and claim to be a full body workout. Welcome.
Thank you. Hi. For having us.
So you are both unlikely people to start an exercise company. Tell me a little bit about your background. Why don't we start with you, Elizabeth?
I grew up in Chicago. I was not one of those kids who was really into sports. And I lived in Colorado for 14 years. And when I was living in Colorado, I got into hiking in particular, which is a great form of cardio. And when I moved back to New York, I met my husband, and I did yoga also. And I continued to do that. And after our children were born, I put on a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And my mother, who I adore, told me, don't worry about what you eat. I wore my jeans home from the hospital. And sadly enough, that was not my experience whatsoever. And about 6 weeks after our first daughter was born, I still had 45 pounds to go. And one of my dearest friends just said to me, you have got to get some cardio. And I was so intimidated. I was afraid. And I went to take a class. And a light really went off for me. I really felt like if I could access this, then so many people who feel like they can't do cardio could access this, and it could really change something for them, because everybody needs cardio and most people hate it.
Now, this was an indoor cycling class. Can you explain what a spin class or an indoor cycling class is for those who have never taken one?
At SoulCycle, we ride on indoor cycling bikes, and we have pedals that people use specific bike shoes to clip into. And what's great about that is that you're using your entire leg. But so basically what it is it's riding inside on a stationary bike in a class that's set to music and led by a teacher.
Elizabeth, you sold real estate in Colorado when you were living there.
I was. I had grown up in a real estate family. My mother was a very successful real estate broker in Chicago, and I ended up moving to Telluride. And while I was there, I got introduced to an arm of Oriental medicine called Jin Shinjitsu. So because of the lifestyle that exists in Colorado, I was able to do both, but just wasn't really the money that I would need to sort of live my life.
So you moved to New York City and you discovered indoor cycling. At what point did you say, you know what, this would be an interesting business to start?
You know, my sister-in-law owns Bikram Yoga, is a co-owner of Bikram Yoga here in the city. And so she was, I said to her, you know, I'm feeling this urge to do this. I mean, I had a five-month-old and a three-year-old. And she was really encouraging.
And how about you, Julie? You were a talent manager in Los Angeles.
I was in LA for about 9 years. And not unlike Elizabeth, I sort of had, you know, an aha moment on a bike. I've always been sort of athletic, but it's never really had a joyful effect on me before. I thought to myself, I get it. I understand why this can be something that's not just, you know, checking off, you know, exercise today on my to-do list.
What's an example of the impact that SoulCycle has had, not necessarily just physically?
Our experience now over and over again is people coming up to us and saying, you know, I don't go to my therapist anymore because I do it on the bike. Or I literally walked into the Upper East Side studio the other day and a woman came up to me and she said, I want you to know that you saved my life. She said, I just had a baby and I started working out here right after, you know, my child was born and you really saved my life. And I said to her, I'm so glad to hear it. You look amazing. How old is your child? And she said, oh, my baby is 5 months old, but that's not at all what I'm talking about. She explained that it really helped her connect to her child and back to herself and to her family. For us, the surprise gift in this business has been the emotional release that it has given to people.
When you noticed the benefits of doing a spin class, why did you necessarily say, I'd like to start a business? Where did that come from?
Truth be told, I sort of looked high and low for an experience that would make me feel like what I had found in my, you know, little indoor cycling studio in Los Angeles. I tried every indoor cycling class in New York City, and I just could not find it.
Was there also some unhappiness with your current work environment that kind of gave you the extra push to say, you know what, I'd like something new?
Definitely. Well, one thing that Elizabeth and I have very much in common were we both started the business when we had babies that were 5 months old. After I had my daughter, I definitely was feeling like I would like to figure out a job where I could work on my own terms.
So you both had this idea in isolation. How did you ultimately meet each other?
We met at a lunch. We were introduced and we started to talk.
By a mutual friend.
Yes. And slowly but surely, we started to talk about the ideas that we had for creating an indoor cycling business. I like this about this place, but I think this could be better. Or wouldn't it be great if you could do some upper body work in the 45 minutes? Or could you imagine if
we had a reservation system?
Right. Or it was a chic environment. Mm-hmm. Or all the teachers spoke the same language, so you didn't go to, you know, Joe's class at 10 in the morning and it was boot camp, and, right, you know, what Bill's class at 10 o'clock in the evening and it was, you know, Zen cycle. We always say it was the best blind date we ever went on.
Have you looked at some studies that show the benefits of group exercise versus exercising on your own, for example?
If you drew a chart, you would probably see that the workout for a group of people is more consistent than one person working out by themselves. If you are out there on the West Side Highway running by yourself, on a low day you might run a little slower, and on a fast day you might run a little faster, but probably you are working at a pretty hard level if you are in a class at SoulCycle, because the group is going to carry you with them.
Incidentally, indoor cycling classes take place in the dark. Where did that come from?
For us, we do ride in candlelight, and it sort of sets the tone of a respectful room, a place where people are there for the right reasons. We have this site on our page on our site called Soul Etiquette, which is just about, you know, how we treat each other. I mean, we really treat it as a sanctuary.
I noticed the music plays such a prominent role. Can you talk a little bit about the music and really, there's a DJ component to it?
Absolutely. Our instructors spend a lot of time creating their playlists. You know, there's a musical arc that follows the emotional arc, that follows the physical arc.
We have a place on the site where we put our 10 favorite songs of the month. We went through a real phase, and I think it's a classic. We'll always love the Alicia Keys and Empire State of Mind.
Alicia Keys and Jay-Z. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guests are Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle, a group of indoor cycling studios in New York City, the Hamptons, and Los Angeles. So I want to switch to the nuts and bolts of how you started your business. So you had this excellent first date where you said, okay, I want to get started. So what were the first steps that you took?
Elizabeth started looking for spaces.
We were combing Manhattan. We weren't coming up with much. I mean, people don't really want to rent to, especially at that time in 2006, to people who have no track record whatsoever. So we managed to find a sublet in the back of a lobby on 72nd Street, great located, very well located on Craigslist. And we thought there was going to be a sign. And then just as we went to go sign the lease, they said, oh, I'm very sorry, but you don't have a sign and you're never going to have one. And if you would like to have one, it'll be inside the lobby on your door. So we did a lot of guerrilla marketing. We got a rickshaw, which we painted. We painted it silver and yellow, which are two colors that we use. And we parked it out in front of the studio and locked it up, hoping that it wouldn't get stolen or ticketed. And we'd say, oh, should we spend another $65 on the ticket for this night so that people know where we are?
Well, we literally used to get a ticket every day from the community board for parking our rickshaw outside. And we parked out there for a long time until finally
stolen.
The community board wanted to actually see us.
Right. And then it got stolen. It was sort of a happy accident.
And how long did it take you from your first meeting to opening the doors on the first day?
4 months.
Yeah.
Quick. After our first meeting, Elizabeth started looking for space immediately. And, you know, we didn't even know each other very well. So I was still working at my full-time job. And we would sort of talk in the morning and make our separate to-do lists. And I would schedule my lunch break. So, you know, I was representing models at the time. And, you know, I would sort of be creating shampoo deals and stuff. And then during lunch, I would meet the towel guy downstairs. We really just sat down and made a list. Things you need for cycling: water, bikes, shoes, a space. Elizabeth went to IKEA and created most of our first studio out of IKEA cabinetry. Our front desk and our original studio is from good old IKEA.
And Elizabeth, you were also an investor in the beverage company Izzy, which was ultimately sold to Pepsi. How did you come to be one of the early investors in Izzy?
My best friend from college and her husband, who I grew up down the street from, happened to get married, and they started this company after their first daughter was born. We had seen it in Colorado, and, you know, I said to my husband, I said, well, I think we should put some money in it, and I called Todd, and he said, I cannot take your money. I'm going to lose it. I really cannot do this. And I said, okay, I completely understand, but I'm an adult, and if you change your mind, let me know. And 2 days later, he called, and he said, we just got a huge order from Whole Foods. It's our first big order, and we have no money to fill the order, so we will be glad to take your check. And then it was really just a really amazing, happy coincidence. I mean, we had the money to do what we needed to do. Sort of, it was extremely timely. The business was pretty successful from the beginning, but it just took the pressure off us in terms of, you know, paying back investors.
So were you the sole investor initially for the company?
Yes, I was.
So tell me a little more about the logistics of getting the business off the ground. What are some other kind of surprises that, you know, didn't go the way that you had hoped initially?
We put a lot of time into developing an online reservation system. So we would open the reservation system noon on Mondays. The bikes would open for the week, and you could just sign up for the classes that you wanted. And we got to a point in the business where things got, as we started to add classes to the studio, things got really busy. And so the system would crash at noon on Monday, which is like the last thing in the world that you want to happen, because you make people so mad. We really had to work through the technology of that.
We didn't know a lot about soundproofing in the beginning. Or how close people live to a building that you're playing music in.
Did you get complaints from neighbors or?
Oh, neighbors, other tenants, landlords. It was one of those. And it was like we threw every expensive Band-Aid on the ceiling that we could.
Well, we had hired a contractor at the behest of our of our broker who said he knew about soundproofing because he did porn studios in Midtown. And so we thought, well, these people really know what they're doing. And when it came right down to it, that technology did not work at all. We were so horrified because we thought we were doing good.
I will say on a larger scale, you know, we really, when we created this business, we actually created a very atypical model, which I think for us was probably one of the biggest obstacles in the beginning. New York had not really yet adopted the concept of boutique fitness, meaning a pay-per-class model, a pay-per-class cardio model. It's one of those things where you pay your money, you know, on a monthly membership to a gym, and you can take spin class. And so it's always a throw-in, a gimme. So I would say that for the first, you know, 6 months, a year, I mean, it was just a barrage of phone calls all day where you'd pick up the phone and the person on the other end would say, "This is included in my membership. Why would I pay you for something that I already get for free?" They were sort of outraged, actually.
You should tell that story about your father.
Oh, well, I remember showing my dad the first studio, and he walked in, and he looked around, and he looked for the showers, and he couldn't find them. And he came a couple months after we'd been open, and he looked at me, and he said, "People really come here?" And I said, "Yeah, people really come here, and the people that come here really like it." And I could just see him looking at my mother. Desperately afraid that we were not going to be able to send our child to college. The real truth is that there were rooms with bikes in them.
And you showed him.
Yeah. Sort of.
He's impressed now. He is impressed. It's very sweet to see how proud he is of Julie.
Given that this was, to some extent, a lifestyle change for both of you, given that you both had five-month-olds, did you have ambition to open up more than one studio, or did kind of success just create the inertia to get you to expansion mode?
Well, in the beginning, we thought if we had one great studio, that was...
Or maybe three.
But. That was really... I mean, but we really, you know, we had a certain number of riders, and we thought, oh my goodness, if we could get 50 people here every day, this would just be it. Imagine the feeling of the first morning that, you know, we opened the door and there was a full class. I mean, I can vividly remember the feeling of the first person that did not get a bike in a class.
And when did that happen?
I mean, that was maybe three or 4 or 5 months in.
Was there a catalyst? Meaning, what were those turning points, either in people or press, that really helped escalate your success?
Well, it's funny that you say that, because when we first opened the studio, I lived across the street. My husband and my daughter and I lived in a tiny rent-controlled apartment that we were busting at the seams growing out of. But on Sundays, I would, you know, sort of, you know, feed Phoebe her bottle and then say, "Oops, got to go put the garbage out. Tomorrow morning, the garbage guys are coming," you know, or maybe they left the candles burning from the last class. I should go check. I mean, it was that kind of a hands-on. We did everything. And I remember that when our first articles would come out, I would say to Elizabeth, "The New York Times is coming out tomorrow. I'm going to get to the studio at 5 a.m. because I can imagine what the phone calls are going to be like, you know, beg my husband, "Can you watch the baby this morning?" And we would sit there. And maybe if we got one or two phone calls the whole day. I mean, it was no more or no less than any other day at SoulCycle in the beginning. We had a perfect storm sort of a little bit into our business, and this is kind of what it was. The viral marketing started to pick up, and people started to come.
And people really brought their friends. I mean, it was like that commercial, the hair commercial.
You know, 80s. I told a friend, and they told
two
friends.
and so on, and it really was like that.
Then a bunch of press did come out, and then we opened a studio in Bridgehampton. So many people go out to vacation out in the Hamptons in the summer, and we thought it would be a really great way to spread the word. And it was really that fall, after that summer, that our business really started to pop.
And any kind of one celebrity that happened to come in that caused kind of a wave effect?
It was Bill Clinton. We did a fundraiser when Hillary was running for president, and we decided to raise money for Hillary's campaign. And
It was through a rider.
And she helped us to get President Clinton there.
He didn't ride.
But he came and he spoke about
healthcare.
And then we did a ride with what we assumed would have been his favorite songs if he had actually rode the bike. you know what? It was a slow news day. And everyone came. There was nothing else going on in the world except that President Clinton was speaking at SoulCycle. And I remember, and this was great, we called a company that did billboards on Fifth Avenue, and we begged them to stay up all night and make a wrap for the front doors of SoulCycle because we had no sign. And we knew that news crews would be outside wanting to shoot President Clinton going in because nobody could get inside the event. And so we had them create a facade that covered the entire doors so that when you pulled it open, it was a big wheel. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, I mean, our logo made it all over the news. It was on Entertainment Tonight, and it was on the New York Times and the Daily News. And it was really a big, big thing for us.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jessica.
Nice to be here.
My guests have been Elizabeth Cutler and Julie Rice, co-founders of SoulCycle. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.